This is the Guy Gordon Show on News Talk 760 WJR. Sitting in today, WJR's Chris Renwick.
I want to take you back to January 12th of 2016. Why was that day particularly notable? Well, it was then President Obama's last State of the Union address. And the GOP's response was conducted and handled by then Governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley. And it was the first time, at least for me, that Nikki Haley was on my radar. And I thought, man, this is a future president. The way that the response was, the tone, I thought Nikki Haley just skyrocketed in a lot of people's minds. She didn't mind. And now we get word that Nikki Haley will be running for president. She will be running for the GOP nomination in 2024. And the only other Republican that has planned and officially announced was and is Nikki Haley's former boss in Donald Trump. What does this mean? What does this mean for the field of GOP hopefuls for that position? What kind of launching pad just does Nikki Haley getting into the mix signal for the GOP? John Selleck, the founder and CEO of Harbor Strategic Public Affairs, he joins us this afternoon in the Guy Gordon Show. John, nice to have you with us. This sounds like a move that was at least maybe in the works for a while. Nikki Haley's been hinting at this, and now we're going to get an official word in just 2 weeks from now. But what does this mean for the GOP, particularly in the presidential hopefuls going forward?
Well, hey, Chris, thanks for having me here. You know, you said maybe this looks like it's been in the works for a while. And after being in politics for a long time, I tend to believe that almost everybody that ends up running for president secretly harbored being president since they were like 4 or 5 years old. So they've all been planning. I don't think we can mistake that. But it means a few things. It means that Donald Trump does not have an iron grip on the party at this point. It means somebody who actually worked for him is daring and willing to run against him and get in the race, which will probably open the door for a few others, you know, like Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. It also means maybe the party is reawakening a little bit, because a Nikki Haley getting into the race, when you just look at her on the paper resume, is a completely normal GOP candidate for president, a two-term governor of a conservative state, one that just happens to come right before Super Tuesday in South Carolina. She's skilled on television. She carries the advantage of being one of the very few women leaders in the Republican Party today. She's a first-generation American success story. She even was the governor to sign the bill that got the Confederate flag down off the South Carolina Capitol. So there's so much there that makes sense for her to get into this race. But, you know, I saw a headline earlier where it said Trump oddly relaxed by Nikki Haley getting in. And I think that's because the most important part for Trump is the more people who get in and mix it up with DeSantis means the better shot of Trump getting across the victory line, maybe even with only a plurality.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to give you some of the quotes from a weekend campaign stop, actually, in South Carolina. Trump told reporters that he had heard from Haley. She told him that she's considering running for the GOP nod in 2024. He said, I talked to her for a little while. I said, look, you know, go by your heart if you want to run. She called me and said, I'd like to consider it. And I said, you should do it. Trump then told Haley, go by your heart if you want to run. That is not if I gave you this quote is by Anonymous, you would not think that was from Donald Trump.
No, you wouldn't. And I guess, you know, first of all, we know that he has his favorites. Just like Governor Whitmer is one of President Biden's favorites, and he may have a soft spot for her in his heart. Who knows? But what he does know is that anybody that joins the race, that maybe takes some votes away from a Ron DeSantis, is an ally of his. And so he's going to welcome her in. And also, just not good form to just start attacking one of the few Republican women to ever run for president after he just basically had to mix it up with DeSantis, you know. You know, calling him disloyal and saying he was rewriting this history on vaccines. because those two are starting to scrap. And I do believe while Haley had been planning this, she saw that opening and said, all right, I got to jump in there now before anyone else does.
And again, this is going to this is a field where we just saw an alert moments before we came on the air. Tim Scott is going to embark on a listening tour to see if this is something that he should get into the mix. So South Carolina could be very involved in the GOP party for the run for president in 2024. And again, this is on the heels of looks like Mike Pence is going to run. Obviously, Ron DeSantis hasn't confirmed it, but he's done all but confirm it. Liz Cheney, the former Republican, is said to be in the mix as well. And you mentioned Mike Pompeo. I'm going to be really interested here because I take you back to 2015 or 2016. It was the South Carolina primary when Pete Buttigieg dropped out and a couple of other high profile Dems that were running at the time. And they all threw their support behind Joe Biden. And that's when he really started taking off over Bernie Sanders. I think once some of these folks start dropping out, who they throw their weight behind, I think is going to be very interesting. I also wanted to ask you real quick about Michigan's decision. Now the House and the Senate have voted to move Michigan to an earlier spot in the presidential primary cycle, the fourth week of February. And we're getting word that the governor actually just signed this bill. So now this will be moved to the fourth week of February. It'll be the fifth in line of primaries. What do you make of this?
Well, first and foremost, what it is Governor Whitmer trying to help President Biden. He's saying to her, help me win the state, make it easier for me, the Democrats. And frankly, if you just step back 5 feet, a lot of business people, a lot of TV stations, a lot of radio stations, a lot of small businesses that will really appreciate the boom that we would have here in Michigan, at least for a few weeks in spending. They want to see it all happen. Realistically, though, the Democrats are rushing to do this, even though they will, because they did not get immediate effect on that bill, they would actually have to do something that's never happened before in our modern times. They'd have to shut down the legislature by November so that 90-day window after session ends would happen before the primary. So that's kind of tough. And they're essentially, I think the Republicans are making a really good case that the Democrats are disenfranchising a big chunk of people because they know the RNC did not change their schedule. Michigan Republicans would lose a lot of voting strength and a lot of their voice for their primary, and the Dems don't seem to care about it a lick.
Well, is that a folly here for the GOP and the RNC? Should they have known, or should they have and maybe guessed that Michigan would be moved up in the pecking order?
Well, you know, these rivalries and desires for all these states to move up and get out from under the thumb of Iowa and New Hampshire have been going on as long as I've been in politics. I think the gamesmanship is far from being done at this point. But, you know, in the not-too-distant past, the Democrats went ahead. They lost some of their delegates. They managed to get a few back because Hillary Clinton wanted to gain favor with folks here in Michigan. I think this kind of back-and-forth battle is going to go for a while. Should no one challenge Joe Biden, though, perhaps the Democrats won't end session early. They won't let that bill go into effect, and we'll all have our primary election day on the same day. But it does, without a doubt, right now, under the current system, guarantee that Republicans will have to do something different than having a primary. And that's anti-democratic. And the Democrats have already done a really good job with most of their spin in the beginning of the legislative session. They're doing it again, saying, oh, gosh, the Republicans want to have a separate primary and have spend more of the taxpayers' money, as if the Republicans are the ones messing things up. But they have been very good at that so far, and that this kind of line of messaging does not surprise me.
John Salek, always appreciate the time, my friend. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
I got to take a break. The FBI, we'll get you more information on the governor signing this bill. Also, the FBI has searched and concluded their search of President Biden's vacation home in Delaware. Give me some of that information on the other side. This is the Guy Gordon Show on WJR. All right, welcome back. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has now signed this bill to move Michigan's presidential primary forward. It would be the fifth state to hold a presidential primary. But whether or not that takes effect in time for 2024 is, it remains to be seen. And it remains to be seen because, according to the law, there needs to be a 90-day grace period, basically, from the time session ends to the time the primary starts. So if the session were to go over November 29th, it wouldn't take effect. So if they ended earlier, well, then it would take effect. So that is just breaking this afternoon. Also, wanted to let you know what's going on with the FBI. The FBI today conducted a search of President Joe Biden's vacation home in Delaware. They found no classified documents, although they did take with them some handwritten notes and some other materials that they will review. It was a 3.5-hour search. And, you know, everybody on the left, the White House, his counsel, says they're being transparent. They're being transparent. Just by saying you're being transparent doesn't mean you're being transparent. Once again, this raid, this investigation into this particular property didn't happen until there was a leak, until somebody in the media reported it. So it wasn't that the Biden camp was saying, hey, everybody, just want to let you know the FBI's coming to my house today. They're going to take another look-see. Just by saying you're being transparent doesn't mean you're being transparent. Today, the president's counsel was out in front of the White House taking questions from reporters. Ah, well, we'll let you, we'll refer you to the DOJ. We'll refer you to the DOJ. We'll refer you to the DOJ. It would be improper for me to speak on behalf of the DOJ and their process. That's not transparency. So I'm happy that no other classified documents were found, although even handwritten notes can be considered classified depending on the material there. And then today, Corinne Jean-Pierre in the White House press room was asked, how many classified documents? Well, what's the number? How many documents do we have now? How many have been discovered? And at this point, she declined to answer. She refers you to the DOJ. Yeah, well, then the reporter says, yeah, the president's counsel didn't answer that question either. And then laughed and said, well, I guess that's your answer then. This is the problem. Because you say you're being transparent doesn't mean you are. Bob Bauer, the attorney for the president, said that like last month's search of the Wilmington, Delaware home, agents took for further review some materials and handwritten notes that appear to relate to his time as vice president. This, of course, now the second residence that has been searched by the president. And where this thing goes from here, I don't know. Again, you've got a special counsel looking into this. What other potential locations, properties that could be searched, we don't know yet. But again, this was full support, cooperation with the DOJ. Okay. Well, look, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Because everything does at this point seem to be on the up and up. Everything's above board. But I think for real transparency to be impactful, then you have to be forthcoming with some information, understanding that there is an investigation, a serious investigation going on. I don't need nuts and bolts and all, but coming forth with some information, I think, would be helpful. Now you've got Tim Scott saying that he's going to go on a listening tour. So you've got South Carolina heavy in the mix here as we start approaching, you know, a real catalog of GOP contenders for the nomination for 24. And look, I think going back to her time as governor, I think to going back, again, for me, it was the rebuttal to then-President Obama's final State of the Union address. I thought she was wonderful. I thought she had catapulted herself in the Republican circles. And then, conversely, she was tapped to be the U.N. ambassador under Donald Trump. I think Nikki Haley is a legit player here. And again, I like Tim Scott, too. I think Tim Scott's a real factor here. At the end of the day, though, it really feels like a two-horse race, doesn't it? It really feels like this is Trump, this is DeSantis. That's where this is headed. And again, I think John Selleck's right. When all of these people are throwing their hat into the ring and Donald Trump is saying things like follow your heart, things like if this is something you feel like you should do, follow your heart and of course get in. I think Selleck brings up a good point. Maybe you take away those votes that maybe would have gone Ron DeSantis' way and you throw them behind her, you're splitting votes, and Donald Trump wins this thing again.
And she's the first, I feel like she's the first Republican candidate to announce to offer a little bit of contrast, because it seems like you said, right now it's a two-horse race between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, and it feels like...
And DeSantis isn't even officially in this thing.
Right, but in the voter's mind, he already is running. And really, I mean, Ron DeSantis is doing really well with former Trump voters who wish Trump was a little more electable. So it seems like it's those two versus Nikki Haley who takes a little bit more of a moderate approach.
Definitely a more moderate approach. But again, this is still somebody that was in Trump's cabinet. This is still somebody who is a conservative. This is a principled Republican. And I think a lot of people were impressed with her, and I think that having somebody like her in the race, somebody who is, I mean, this isn't just, you know, congressman here, representative here. This is somebody with a legit political background, and somebody who I think has grown a lot in the party over the last decade or so. So I just think it's very interesting that Nikki Haley gets into the race. If you want to get, I'd love to hear your take on this. Nikki Haley running, potentially Tim Scott going on a listening tour and jumping in the mix. I mean, this is in South Carolina now being the lead primary state. This is South Carolina. The spotlight is on. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. Is this really for good now, Nick? Do you think this is it?
I think he's done.
You think he's done?
Yep.
Like done. Why? But why is this different than last year?
I don't know why it's different, but you can't retire twice and come back twice.
So the tone, is it the tone? Is it just...
Yeah.
Was it on the dunes there and in Miami? Is that what it was?
All by himself? It was kind of awkward.
All right, we'll tell you who retired next on the Guy Gordon Show.
Good morning, guys. I'll get to the point right away. I'm retiring for good. I know the process was a pretty big deal last time, so when I woke up this morning, I figured I'd just press record and let you guys know first. So I won't be long-winded. Like, you only get one super emotional retirement essay, and I used mine up last year. So really thank you guys so much to every single one of you for supporting me.
That's it. The GOAT's done. Tom Brady says he's retiring for good from football. 23-year career, 7 Super Bowls, 10 Super Bowl appearances. He holds every record. I mean, there's nothing else to accomplish, so why put yourself through it? But he's a football guy through and through, Steve Courtney. And it's the end of a very long era, it feels like.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, Chris. How are you, my friend? Good afternoon once again, everybody. This conversation brought to you by my good friends at Bill Brown Ford, located here in beautiful Livonia. The hardworking team at Bill Brown Ford, and of course, the main man, Matt Garco, have done it again. Bill Brown Ford finished atop the dealership world once again in 2022. So congratulations to them, one and all. Shop their True View inventory at BillBrownFord.com today. Well, just like last year, Chris, Tom Brady woke up and said, wait a minute, it's February 1st. I better announce my retirement. Maybe the difference is, a year ago, that retirement lasted 40 days, and he went back to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, as you alluded to, sir. He says this time around, it's for good. And you know what? I think in a perfect world, Chris, see if you agree, he would have called it quits in storybook fashion after his first year in Tampa, mm-hmm. they win the Super Bowl. I think that would have been a beautiful way to take a bow and get off the stage. It didn't work out that way, and perhaps with some sacrifice with his family. But that's something that he is going to have to work out with his wife, Giselle. Will this be enough to get them back together? Boy, I certainly hope so. But anyway, I digress. He does have a very lucrative $36 million a year analyst job waiting for him at Fox.
And it does feel like you're less likely to break a limb there. You know, you're less likely to get concussed. And not to say Tom Brady isn't in superb shape, because he is, but I mean, when you are in your mid 40s playing a game that, you know, you're playing against guys whose fathers played against Tom Brady, I mean, it's a different game, and there's nothing else for him to accomplish.
Zero. And, listen, I've said it 1,000 times and make this 1,001. You know, Father Time is undefeated. And Tom Brady would be turning 46 years of age in August. And again, nothing old about 46, unless, of course, you're a legendary NFL quarterback. And, you know, Chris, there's been so much speculation over a period of time once, you know, the Buccaneer season ended. Where is he going to go? Well, one of the teams, the Miami Dolphins, there was some speculation about that. They came out this past week and said, now we're heading in a different direction. The Raiders have been mentioned. There's also been a thought that he would go back and play one final year in New England with the Patriots. You know, it's not going to happen. And maybe, just maybe, in his mind's eye, Tom Brady, who, as you so eloquently put, what else does he have to play for? Absolutely nothing. You know, just decided, look, I'm not going to be the guy that hangs out too long. We've seen it in sport time and time again, and it's sad. And you certainly, with everything that he's accomplished, you certainly didn't want to see Tom Brady go through that.
No, and look, I mean, I know they had high hopes for this year. They had injuries, especially on that offense. The wide receivers were banged up all year, and they could never really they just never got their wheels going. But it does feel like a bit of a letdown that this season, the way it ended, for him to go out like that. But he got nothing to hang his head down. I mean, he's done everything in this game that you could possibly achieve, and he goes out a winner still. And he's still, I was going around asking today, do you think Tom Brady gets in the the Hall of Fame? I was asked. I was polling people in the station today, and they thought I was crazy, but I thought it was fun. Hey, I want to ask you, too. We've been so worried about Ben Johnson. We've been so worried about Aaron Glenn and these guys taking other jobs. But we've got now the assistant head coach of this team for the Lions, running backs coach Deuce Staley. He's out. Where's he going?
Yeah, Dan Graziano, Chris, is the one that got this out early. He is going to be joining Frank Reich's staff with the Carolina Panthers.
Wow.
And, you know, kind of a surprise, because you go back to the Hard Knocks days, and Deuce Staley, one of the more energetic coaches throughout that series. Mm-hmm. And I think he truly enjoyed it here with DeAndre Swift and Jamal Williams and, you know, the whole running back deal, and the fact and you got to believe he was also under the impression, like Ben Johnson, that this Lions organization on the cusp of something special. Then, you know, we find out through Justin Rogers, the fine Lions beat writer for the Detroit News, who tweeted out confirming Deuce Staley is leaving for Carolina. It's still unclear what his role will be with the Panthers, but OC is in play. Mm-hmm. Lions let him go to be closer to his mother, who is dealing with some health issues. And geographically, Deuce Staley is from South Carolina. So for personal reasons, this move makes, you know, a lot of sense. And there is some familiarity, Chris, with Frank Reich, the new head coach of the Panthers, as well as Deuce Daly. They were both on the Eagles staff.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Reich, the offensive coordinator in 2016 and 17. Deuce, the running backs coach there, 2013 through 2020. So he's going to go to somebody he is very familiar with.
Yeah, and he's a fiery guy. You're right. I thought getting to see him on Hard Knocks was a lot of fun. He's a fiery guy, smart football mind, obviously a former player, ton of pedigree. And we wish him luck. We're going to miss him because I thought that running back room, you know, even with DeAndre Swift injured and obviously Jamal Williams breaking Barry Sanders' touchdown record, I mean, they did perform well under his tutelage, so we will miss him. I also wanted to mention, too, we got a couple names, a couple more Lions added to the list of names for the Pro Bowl coming up next weekend. In fact, it's four now for Detroit, right?
I believe that is the running number.
So
yes.
We got Goff is the addition.
Yes.
He's joining Frank Ragnow, Penei Sewell, and Amon-Ra St. Brown.
As it should be.
Yeah.
As it should be, because when the original list came out, there was a lot of people raising an eyebrow, in particular about Amon-Ra.
Right.
So, you know, and let's just give a big round of applause to the NFL, because they stopped playing that stupid Pro Bowl game that made absolutely no sense. And now it's going to be kind of like skills weekend, a flag football game, whatever the case may be. So, you know.
I know you weren't a fan. I wasn't a fan either. But to replace it with flag football feels a little
weird. At least we know what the deal is.
Yeah,
you know,
as
opposed to playing a real game of football under the guise of it meaning something. And it meant absolutely nothing.
I always liked those silly unis, and they didn't play. They weren't playing.
Yeah, it was silly. Anyway, getting back quickly to Tom Brady and that $36 million a year analyst job. Remember, you know, Troy Aikman and Tony Romo, they dropped jaws when they got $18 million to do what they're doing. And, you know, Greg Olson, who has been the lead analyst on Fox since all that went down, he's made a hell of a name for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to bring in Tom Brady at $36 million, and he's never done it before. Is he going to like it? Is he going to be any good at it? Now that's going to be something to keep an eye on.
I just hope he'll be able to feed his family off that contract.
Something tells me there'll be no clipping coupons like there ever has been at the Brady household.
Steven, good to talk with you. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Chris, have a great rest of the day.
You do the same. There he is, WJR senior sports analyst Steve Courtney here on the Guy Gordon Show. More next. Does governmental immunity provide a shield for Oxford High School officials that are being sued over their actions stemming from that horrific shooting in November of 2021? That's the question, and that's the decision that a judge is going to have to make, which they say will be coming sooner rather than later. WJR senior news analyst Lloyd Jackson taking a look at that story for us, and he joins us this afternoon. Hey, Lloyd.
Good afternoon, Chris. Yeah, legal teams were in court today arguing whether or not employee of Oxford High School could be sued in a pending civil case against the district over the school shooting that took place back in 2021. What was in front of the court during the hearing in Oakland County Circuit Court was the issue of governmental immunity. The state governmental immunity law offers broad protections for officials accused of negligence for acts carried out during the course of their job, making it difficult for the state's residents to sue public employees or agencies. After hearing arguments this morning, Judge Ellen Brennan said she will have a decision sooner rather than later on the issue. Multiple families of the victims of the mass shooting that left four dead and several others injured are being represented by attorney Vin Johnson, who feels that the lawsuits have met their burden to overcome the governmental immunity statute. The victims' families are alleging that the school district failed to protect students. Named in the lawsuit were counselors and administrators. The suit alleges that school employees ignored signs from 15-year-old Ethan Crumley that indicated that he had some mental issues and showed an obsession with guns and violence. Ethan Crumley and both of his parents, James and Jennifer, are also named in the suit. Named as defendants in the case are two school counselors, Pam Fine and Sean Hopkins, Nick Ejak, who is the dean of students, and three other unnamed teachers are also named there. And over a dozen lawsuits have been filed against Oxford High School and its officials since the mass shooting in November of 21, accusing the school leaders of gross negligence. Ethan Crumbly, as you know, pleaded guilty last October to all 24 criminal charges facing him, including first-degree murder. You know that carries life in prison without parole. His parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, they're charged with involuntary manslaughter. Their trial has yet to start.
This is one of the biggest issues, I think, in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, I understand that the reason the governmental immunity exists. But when it comes to kids, when it comes to schools and protecting these kids, this is part of the gig. This is part of the job.
Yeah.
And so should they be held to that standard? I mean, is there any indication which way the judge is leaning in this case?
No, other than the fact that she says she's going to do it sooner than later. The fact that she said that lets me know that, you know, this is something that she's not going to have, you know, long and drawn out, that she's going to make that quick decision.
And then I think it, you know, these decisions and the due diligence that adjudicators then need to go through in these types of cases, I think is only exacerbated when you take into effect, you've got members of the Oxford School Board of Education that are coming out and saying, guys, they didn't do enough.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't follow protocol. And what protocols were in place, they did it to meet a standard. Like, there was no real due diligence done from the school's perspective. And again, it's hard for me not to take a stance that's anything but the families,
the kids,
community,
and
the victim.
Yeah.
It's hard to feel like something like this can happen and nobody's held accountable.
Well, I think whatever the judge decides, you know, that won't be the end of it.
No.
It won't be the end. You know, it'll be appealed or, you know, it'll go,
sure.
You know, and so either or so this is the beginning. It's definitely not the end, not yet.
I think you mentioned the school's defense attorney, Timothy Mullen, says they're looking to have the case thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because they say the claims just don't meet the standard. Of what governmental immunity wouldn't be able to cover. It's a shame. I just, you know, again, I'm what makes me so mad in this case that has gone on since it happened is the investigations that we've been promised and that have not come forward. And it just feels like the further you get, the cloudier everything is, and you don't really get a good grasp, a good understanding of what happened. And that's a problem.
It is. And, you know, this continues with all of these hearings and all of this. It continues to rehash that day for victims and parents and families, and you mm-hmm. just keep rehashing and rehashing. And, you know, it's something you'll never forget, of course, but you want to try to get past it. Here it is, 2023. It's still ongoing, and it's more to come.
Yeah, more to come. All right, Lloyd Jackson, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. 800-859-0957. We've been talking about a number of issues today. One of them being Nikki Haley throwing her hat into the ring for the GOP nod. I think it's a really interesting piece of the eventual outcome, whoever it's going to be. I find it that in this case, how these candidates eventually drop out and where they throw their support behind. Because again, Donald Trump saying, oh, look, if this is what you want, just follow your heart. Maybe he knows that she's going to take more of Ron DeSantis's voters than his voters. And that might propel him to win the GOP nod once again. Dave's in Rochester. What's up, Dave?
Hi, Chris.
Hey.
Two quick items.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Joe Biden model in South Carolina, that's what made him. It wasn't like people pulled out beforehand. He was doing quite poorly. And
he was.
It was 2020. It was
yeah,
2020,
he was.
Not 2015 or 16. But here's the big thing Republicans are missing. First of all, we are not going to just have two or three. It's not going to just be Trump, Nikki Haley, and DeSantis.
Oh, heavens
no.
It
may not go to 15 or 20, okay? It may not go to 15 or 20 like it did in 2016.
I agree. I agree.
Okay, guess what? And if it does go to anything more than a handful or more, I'd like to think how in the world people think that any conclusion other than Trump winning. First of all, he'll be alive. His parents lived to 93 and 88, okay? So he's going to be around. I don't think he's going to be incarcerated. So I'd like to know how anyone thinks that he's not going to win with at least a handful of other candidates. I don't care. DeSantis, you name it. DeSantis, they don't have a chance.
Really?
When you get a handful. No, when you get a handful or more opponents, my God, look at the polling. Those pollings everyone keeps quoting is one-on-one, okay? Go throw in the field of Pence, okay, Pompeo, all that, and then look at those results, okay? So it's going to be
I only take that approach because those seem to be the most rock-solid candidates for that spot, right? Like, as much as I may like Nikki Haley or Tim Scott or whomever, I'm just for the sake of my argument, I base it off of those two. Because I think they've got the biggest base. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they do, but their base is nothing compared to Trump. DeSantis, again, I don't want to sound like a dead horse, but DeSantis' chance is essentially it's a one-on-one, okay? Other than that, Trump, guess what? He could do anything, and he has their loyalty. I mean, my God.
Well, you might be right. You might be right. But I just think for the eventual outcome, you know, it's like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. They were the only real legit candidates. And obviously, at the end of the day, it wasn't how it played out. Joe Biden was by far the best candidate for the DNC. But at the end of the day, I mean, these are the two candidates that I think most Republicans are going to choose from. All right, got to take a break. More on the Guy Gordon Show next. All right, I want to poll you two real quick here. I know because you guys are some of the honest, most honest people I know. No sarcasm there.
Oh?
If you had the ability to use OpenAI's ChatGPT and write a paper for yourself in, you know, eighth grade or ninth grade, would you have done it?
I would not have because I was terrified of, like, getting in trouble.
Okay, that makes sense. Mike?
I probably wouldn't have, but I do have to say I wrote a lot of book reports, not reading the book, but off of SparkNotes.com.
SparkNotes.com.
Yeah, I mean, I did the same thing, but that's not really cheating, right?
No, I don't know.
But I'm with Nick. I mean, I know plagiarism could get you kicked out of school. I probably would feel the same way about AI writing a paper.
I would have absolutely used this.
You know what I might have done? I might have asked them to write a paper and then retyped in my own words. Yeah.
But then you're, yeah, no. Look, if you haven't seen this, the OpenAI is a new artificial intelligence platform. And they've got a function on there called ChatGPT, and you can ask it to do almost anything. So, like, I was messing around with it the other night, and I asked it to write me a paper on Edgar Allan Poe. And in real time, you can see, like it's typing a whole paper. And then if you do it again, it'll come up with a completely different paper than the one it just typed up. And it takes information from the internet, it takes information from all these sources, and then puts it together. Well, of course, stupid kids like me are using it in schools. And teachers and administrations are going, you can't do this. And the other part is, there's no plagiarism here because it's creating it new. It's creating a new document, a new report. And so it's really hard to catch. And so now we are seeing across the country, school districts are turning this away. But some educators are saying, well, wait, hold on a second. Because AI is going to have a place in our education. It's going to have a role. So maybe instead of banning it, we should embrace it somehow. What's the balance? Dr. Steve Matthews is a superintendent of Rockford Public Schools. He joins us this afternoon on the Guy Gordon Show. Doc, has this been something that you've had to deal with at Rockford, or how have you dealt with this?
We have begun to see its influence in the Rockford Public Schools. Our teachers are certainly talking about it, and it's going to be something that we're going to have to try to figure out how to handle. It is something that's going to change the way we do business as we move forward. And so we have to figure out how to embrace it and help our students figure out how to use it effectively.
Because from a teaching perspective, from teachers' perspective, I imagine it's almost impossible to really track where it came from. Although I do think there is a way to see if this was created by an AI program like ChatGPT, but it makes it, there's a whole other level, a whole other layer of difficulty for teachers when they're reading these things or when they're grading them. It presents a whole new set of problems.
It does. You know, you mentioned that you wrote a paper on Edgar Allan Poe, and it probably was a pretty good paper that
it was solid. It was solid.
He created.
Yeah.
And you know, and so if I'm a student, I certainly would be tempted to use it because it certainly would help me get through my assignments more quickly and leave me time to do other things. You know, but as educators, we're trying to help our students become critical thinkers. We're trying to help our students try to figure out how to communicate their ideas effectively. And, you know, and ChatGPT probably has a place there, but I think that we can use it as a source and then help our students see how would this compare to something you would write in class. Does it have the same voice? Does it have the same power as someone who would write it as a person? And so those are the kind of conversations that we're going to have as we move forward.
Well, and the thing you notice is obviously everything is done correctly, whether it's punctuations or citing different things or quotations. All of those things are accurate. And I mean, I think we're in that learning stage. You know, kids are prone to make mistakes and simple mistakes. But those things that I think maybe would alert a teacher to say, did you really write this? Because this is really well done.
Right. And as you indicate, you know, students are in school to learn. And most students don't produce perfect papers. And so it certainly would alert a teacher that they probably either had help or probably was created, by ChatGPT. But on the other hand, you know, you could have students write an in-class paper and then go home and create one with ChatGPT and then compare the two. And they would get an opportunity to critically think about the differences between the two. And they would have an opportunity to say which one communicated more effectively. And so hopefully it will be a tool that will help our students learn and see how to use sources and see how to use information and how to write more clearly. But students still have to use their voice because there's power in the human voice that probably, hopefully, can't be generated the same way by a computer.
So are you more in favor, do you more fall in line with educators and administrators who say, let's bring this in, let's use this as a tool, as a teaching tool, as opposed to trying to ban it and dissuade kids from using it?
I tend to side on the side of using the new tools as they come along. Once we try to ban them, you know, what happens when we try to ban things? It makes them more appealing to students, makes them try to see if they can get away with it. And so I would say I'd be on the side of bringing it in and trying to figure out how to use it as a tool to help improve our students.
Has this been you said that there has been some discussions in the district. What have been the concerns? What have been the positives? What are you hearing?
You know, the concerns clearly are students are going to use it and they're not going to learn how to write effectively and communicate their ideas. And so, you know, as you have learned yourself, you can ask it anything and it will create something. You know, I was messing around with it the other day and asked for information on board, you know, of education policies. And it generated a whole list for me and it generated it in, you know, less under a minute. And so save me a lot of time. But then I have to look at that information and try to figure out how to make it apply to my situation here in Rockford. And so, you know, the conversations that our teachers are having are how do we use this in a way that's going to help our students get better at what they're doing? And there's a strong concern because You know, teachers are busy. If I'm a high school English teacher, I have 130 students in my classroom. Am I going to pay attention at a deep level to every paper that they write? You know, it's a hard job. And so in some ways, our teachers are going to have to figure out how to embrace this and use it effectively to help our students get better.
Very interesting. Certainly pros and cons to both our sides of the argument. Steve Matthews, always good to talk with you and pick your brain. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a very interesting concept. And again, I get the appeal. Like I when I was messing around with it, I get why it's so appealing to kids. I absolutely would have used it. So I certainly understand why kids would want to use it. Real quick, I want to talk to Mike in Bowling Green. Hey, Mike.
Hey there. Hey. So maybe we should look at AI to become the teacher, you know, and eliminate some of the high cost of education and some of the teacher strikes and issues like that.
Yeah, maybe 100 years from now. I don't think that we're nearing that stage yet. And much like we were discussing, having that personal interaction, I think, is still pretty important. So I don't think we see that anytime soon. All right, got to take a break. Should small children, little kids, toddlers, babies, should they be using phones, tablets? Should they be watching TV? Well, a new study says, well, no, they obviously shouldn't, and it could cause them some problems down the road. We'll talk about that next here on The Guy Gordon Show. Welcome back to The Guy Gordon Show. We take a transition from maybe grade school down to a little bit of a younger age because new research is pointing to the fact that most parents, look, we know this. You know, even me as somebody, I've got a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. Any excessive screen time, phones, iPads, TVs, it can be an impairment to babies, the learning, the growth and development of toddlers and their future success. But how much is too much? That is the question. And that is something that WJR senior news analyst Marie Osborne has been taking a deep dive into, and we welcome her. Good morning or good afternoon to you, Marie.
Hi, Chris. This study was done at Harvard University's Center for the Developing Child, and it found that increased screen time during infancy, and we're talking about tablets and TV here, was associated with poor executive functioning once that child reached the age of 9. Executive functioning are mental processes that help us plan, focus attention, remember instructions, and multitask. So these skills influence our success both socially, academically, and of course professionally. The study used a sample of 437 kids. Those kids underwent EEG scans, which looked at the neural pathways of the brain. They did this at the age of 1, 18 months, and 9 years. And researchers found that there was an association between screen time in infancy and attention and executive function at 9 years old. Experts say infancy is a time of rapid learning. And one of the problems with screen use is that kids don't learn much from it. They do learn, though, with interactions from adults and other kids. Babies have a hard time interpreting information presented in two dimensions, which on a screen, that's what it is. And they have trouble distinguishing fantasy from reality. When it comes to emotional regulation, infants and toddlers can learn from their caregivers when they model self-control or help to label emotions and appropriate expressions. Now, for older preschoolers, the experts say, use the screen time strategically. You don't have to, it shouldn't be verboten. They can use it. They just need to be used strategically. Maybe using it when you have an important Zoom meeting and you need about an hour time or so. The results support the recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Chris. Of course, that organization discourages all screen time before 18 months old, with the exception of video chatting. So I know a lot of grandparents out there are good with that.
Very important. Yeah. No, look, I again, and you now with the grandkid in the mix, it's it's we know that it's important to cut down on some of these things. Heck, it's important for us to cut down on some of these things. But it is you have to balance a couple of things out, right? It's certainly, from my perspective, whenever any of the kids have any sort of screen time, it always, for me, has to be educational. There always has to be some sort of educational lean to it. But then at the same time, you're right. It's all about how you use it, when you use it, how long they're using it, because you don't want to be sucked into that black hole. And then we've gone through the temper tantrums too, where, okay, you've had it for a little while. Now it's done. We're going to move along and do something else. We're going to color. We're going to play. And then the meltdown. And I want it back. And, you know, all of those things happen. So it's true. How often and how you use it is the key.
Absolutely. And although I knew always that, you know, spending too much time in front of a screen was bad for kids, I never really understood why. And the reason was interesting to me, that kids don't learn anything when something is two-dimensional, that they learn by looking at another human and another, maybe another kid, another adult, that something that's happening in front of them, that's where real learning is taking place. And as you know, with the little people, they are learning at such a rapid rate, and their learning is so dynamic. So you don't really want to miss out on that. So again, under the age of 18 months, they're saying, you know, really kind of forego that. But after that, if you give them a little bit of time, it's not going to hurt.
Well, I'll tell you this. We don't really give Henry, who now is one, much screen time.
Right.
But if he finds my phone on the couch or on the ottoman or whatever, he picks it up. He can work it, because he's seen me work it, or he's seen mom on the phone, and he's able to work it. Now, again, I think you're right. I think always the interaction with other kids, with adults, far be it for me to tell people how to parent their kids, but because there are more than two ways to skin a cat. But at the same time, having those interactions are so important.
Yep, that's where all the real learning takes place. I mean, you know, they don't say that, you know, the parents or caregivers, though, they are the first teachers in the lives of our children, and that's why they're just so darn important.
Well, thank God they learned from my wife, not from me. That's the good news.
I'll have to agree with them on that. I will agree with you on that.
Marie, thanks for taking a peek at this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I thought it was such a great topic. Thank you.
Something else I want to throw into the mix here, because this is wild. On Fox News, British Columbia becomes the first province in Canada to decriminalize heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, and other hard drugs. Starting on Tuesday, residents of British Columbia who are older than 18 will be allowed to carry up to 2.5 grams of drugs, such as cocaine, heroin, fentanyl, methamphetamine, morphine. BC was granted permission by the government to try out the plan for 3 years, when the drugs will still be illegal, but those carrying less than 2.5 grams will not be arrested, charged, or have those drugs confiscated. Instead, residents carrying the drugs will be offered information on health and social services. So basically, Jennifer Whiteside, the British Columbia Minister of Health and Addictions, said decriminalizing people who use drugs breaks down the fear and shame associated with substance use and ensures they feel safer reaching out for life-saving support. Advocates for the plan hope it'll address a spike in overdose deaths, which has left 10,000 people dead in British Columbia since 2016. When the country declared drug-related deaths a public health emergency. That is quite an about-face for a region to have 10,000 deaths in not even 10 years from the drugs that you are now decriminalizing. And look, I've always kind of been somebody that said, look, you're not impacting my life. Right. If you want to go do heroin, I don't mess around with that. So, and I don't associate with people like that. So, like, okay. But it is pretty brazen to feel like you had to declare a public health emergency because so many people were dying. And we've seen it here in the United States with the fentanyl-laced drugs that have come in to the United States, killing people rapidly. I mean, you look at some of these drug busts, these fentanyl drug busts, authorities have to wear gloves. They have to wear face protection because you're not supposed to touch it with your skin. But let's totally decriminalize it. That's fine. Feels like this is a step too far. Feels like this is...
Well, it's not totally. It's in small doses.
Yeah. All right. I mean, yes.
I mean, the people who are dealing these drugs aren't free to do it as they please.
Well, and that's always been my contention, right? If you're going to, if people are going to do these drugs anyway, you might as well make money off of it. But, I mean, it feels like there's a line. It feels like fentanyl is a line. Heroin, cocaine, that's a line. I mean, those are hardcore drugs. I don't know. You want to weigh in on 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. Got to take a break. More next. Well, following the death of Tyre Nichols, the brutal beating of Tyre Nichols by five police officers in Memphis, it has resumed the calls for police reform talks in Lansing. A 12-page bill that was introduced last year on the heels of the Patrick Lioia death in Grand Rapids included banning no-knock warrants, chokeholds, establishing new procedures for investigating misconduct incidents, and allowing an officer's license to be revoked if it's determined they use excessive force. In this case, legislative Black Caucus in Michigan, in Lansing, wants to see this bill back in front of legislators because it wasn't voted on in the Loyola case in Grand Rapids. Chris Ronson is the Genesee County Sheriff. He joins us to talk about this. Sheriff, I saw your Facebook post following the Tyre Nichols, the release of the video. And I want to start with you just getting a reaction to what you saw in that police footage.
Disgusting. And when you see people that wear the same uniform that I've wore for 30 years and they act that way and they have a mindset and a culture that is different than what policing is for, it's disgusting and dishonorable.
How damaging is it? Because I know you have done a lot of work in the community to try to build relationships, much like we've seen James White in Detroit, Mike Bouchard in Oakland County, building those relationships in the community so they know that you're there for the reason you're there to protect them. You're there to protect the community. When something like this happens, how damaging is that? Is that trust broken? Does it take a hit? Where do you stand with your community after something like this, do you think?
So you said something when you set this up and you made the comment that folks in Lansing want to resume talks. My question is, why did we stop talking about it? And why is this not a priority among police across not only the state of Michigan, but in the nation? You can't wait for another death to keep building relationships and building public trust. Public trust is very difficult to build and easy to lose. So to your point, the reasons we deploy into the streets of Flint and Genesee County on a daily basis to protect, serve, and unify, because we want to keep from these things happening, not reacting when they do. And so that trust is action-based. I love what Amos O'Neill said when you quoted, he said, there's enough lip service, let's mm-hmm. take action. And action, I'm going to tell you, is just not making arrests. And the word that I use to my staff is we create a culture of police evolution. We just don't treat symptoms. We fix the problems. And you have to, as a leader, police chief or sheriff, you have to make sure that the culture that you're exampling within your agency is exactly that. There's a time to protect, there's a time to serve, and there's a time to unify. And it's every single day.
Do you feel like this bill package, this 12-page bill package, would address the issues that many perceive that exist in policing, or do you feel like it's a Band-Aid? What do you think of this legislation?
Well, first of all, I'd stand with Amos O'Neill shoulder to shoulder and testify in support of evolution when it comes to law enforcement. Many times police see that any change is a negative. I don't. That's why I refer to it as police evolution. We have to evolve as a profession that allows us to do our job better today than we did yesterday. So when you look at the bills that they're talking about, no-knock warrants, why anybody's doing no-knock warrants in America today is beyond my comprehension. There's a process and a procedure to do it. We know it's dangerous. That's why we do what we do. When it comes to the search warrants that we do in Genesee County, I've done over 100 of them last year alone. We have a fully marked police car with lights and sirens. We announce what we're doing. We announce. I talked to Breonna Taylor's sister just 2 days ago, and we saw what happened there. Mm-hmm. So no-knock warrants, there's no place in them. Chokeholds, that's deadly force. That's deadly force. That's need to be seen as deadly force. Chokeholds are not part of the force continuum to get compliance. We have other means to do it. We have pepper spray. We have tasers. We have a force continuum. But chokeholds are not to be used for compliance. That is deadly force. And I think the other big thing is, of course, if you can't train out, discipline out a bad cop, you need to cut it out. And they shouldn't be cop shopping around Michigan, around the country, because their buddy or somebody works in this agency. Dirty cops, police officers that are heavy-handed, that got a history of excessive force, have no business in law enforcement.
How do you identify those types of people? How do you identify what you mentioned, quote unquote, bad cops? How do you identify those types of people?
That's a great question. I'm going to tell you this. Listen to the people. Listen to the people on the street. When we do operations, now I'd say an example in Flint, I took over 4.8 miles of patrol in downtown Flint on July the 1st. And it's a philosophy that we have called Operation Arrowhead. These officers are five chosen veteran officers that are diverse in gender and race, that have a history of dealing with the public in a positive way. I know this because we don't get police complaints. They work well with the community. We talk to the community. They still arrest people, but they do it with professionalism. And police chiefs and, of course, sheriffs, we need to listen to the community. We know at this level, I'm going on, as I said, 31 years. I know when I see somebody who has a bad attitude. I know if somebody tries to get a shot in when something's not right. Like, we see that. You ask anybody in command, they know the people in their office that are rude to people, that are short-tempered, people have a chip on the shoulder. That's the culture that's got to start from the top down. There are great cops out of there that are being tarnished by the bad acts of a few. Get those few out of there, and that's the answer to your question. We know it, and when you see it, identify it and take care of it. Train it out, discipline it out, or cut it out.
What did you make of the job that the police department in Memphis did following this? Do you think they followed the appropriate measures? What was your reaction to that?
So this happened on January the 7th. He passed away on January the 10th. As you know, the video was released last Friday. Mm-hmm. I don't have the privilege to know what happened and transpired there, but I will tell you this. If this was in my agency, because we have cameras like everybody else, and we saw that there was a death within our custody, there's a proper procedure. If there's video, that is the number one best evidence that you can go through. Show the video. That video, just like when George Floyd was murdered, you don't need any more supplements to tell me what happened. So I don't know the timing that things happened, but I will tell you that if it happened in Genesee County Sheriff's Office, I would have seen the video, and those five cops would have arrested that night.
It's I imagine it's a precarious spot to be in, because, you know, you I know in particular have done a lot in Genesee County just to build those relationships.
Right.
So have you talked to people in the community about this? Have you tried to reassure them that this kind of thing won't happen here?
And that's important, is to be proactive and letting the community know that this is not who we are. It's not what we stand for. You mentioned the history that we've had. You know, in May 30th, 2020, in Flint, we were expected to burn. But we had a protest that turned, and it could have gone violent quick, but we chose a different path. When I asked what they needed, they said, walk with us. We walked. That was one of 40 protests in 2020. We didn't have a single arrest, not a single glass broke, not a single riot, not a single business looted. And those messages have not stopped. If you could see the track record, and it's inclusive with all of my law enforcement partners, I'm not the only one out there, but I've taken the lead to make sure that they can at least see that I'm doing everything. When something like this happens, I don't take the position that I have to be prompted to tell people where I stand and what they can expect from their sheriff and their police agency. That's why I put out the post, and that's what you referred to let people know this is where I stand, because you're right, there is a concern of the blue wall and the protection, but good cops love good cops. Good cops don't like bad cops. But in addition to that, I meet with my command staff. I met with all my lieutenants and captains yesterday. I explained to them, this is how we operate here, and affirm that this is our culture. And on top of that, I have ambassadors. I have two returning citizens that I hired full time, John L. Allen and Percy Glover. And these guys are ambassadors between me and the community. They're African Americans, and we've built a great relationship. They go into the communities and we talk to people. You have to be intentional, because people are scared and they want to know if I'm driving down the road, or if my son's driving, if my 29-year-old father of a 4-year-old is driving down the city of Flint, do I expect the same thing from the sheriff's office? And the answer is no. And the only way they're going to know that is for me to tell them.
Well, it's a tragic situation.
Yes,
but we appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this. Chris Swanson, thank you.
Appreciate you.
Yep, there he is, Chris Swanson, the sheriff of Genesee County. Got to take a break. More next on the Guy Gordon. All right, I have an observation on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The nominees are out. A couple of Michigan connections, actually. But we'll get to that in a second. I want to get to a couple of your calls here, 800-859-0957. Mike's in Tecumseh. What's up, Mike?
Yeah, with this police problem, you know, we instead of hiring 86,000 tax people, maybe we should hire 86,000 special cops and find an Elliot Ness. They call these guys the Untouchables and send them in to other police precincts and have them, you know, guide them to a new way. You know, I appreciate good cops know who the bad cops are. Okay. But they can't turn them in.
Why?
Because they get, they die. That's why. It's that bad. I think in big cities, especially, it's that bad.
Well, in big cities, it might be. But yeah, but certainly
maybe even Detroit. But the thing is, in the small cities like Tecumseh here, we've got a great police force, fantastic people, and they're, you know, interpersonal. I remember when I was a kid, maybe they should have more of these guys that come into the schools and show safety movies and stuff. I remember a guy named P.J. Schaefer, who was a cop. He used to come in and show movies. We knew him all our lives.
Well, look, I think with anything, when you get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it, you're right, in big cities, there's corruption seeps in. But the goal here is to get all of that out. And you know, I think Chris Swanson's right. Good cops know who the bad cops are, and good cops know who good cops are. And so the idea here is you have to weed them out. And how you do it, I don't really care how you do it. But this is just something that has become a problem, obviously. Thanks, Mike. Greg's in Shelby Township. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Chris, real quick, Mr. Positive. I'm going to change my subject. I think what we're doing is handcuffing the police and telling them what they can't do in a situation that is life-threatening. Let's say chokeholds, okay? I agree. But all of a sudden, someone jumps on Chris Renwick, and the only way he can do it, because he's an MMA professional, is doing a sidebar, then going into a chokehold and subduing him. And I think we're giving leeway to the criminal by saying, wow, a police officer has to go into a situation and go, how do I address this? I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't do this. I can't do that.
Or being hesitant to react because you can't do things.
Exactly. You just nailed it. And Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, and that puts police in a precarious situation, Greg. I think it's a good point. But if somebody like Chris Watson says, look, we don't need it. That's not something that we need, and it's deadly force, and there are other ways around it. Okay, look, you would know better than me. But you're right. I think there is something to be said about potentially handcuffing police if there's something that could be done, but they can't do it for fear of, you know, legal retribution or something. That's a tough spot to be in. So the nominee list for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's out. And there are a number of notable names on here. Kate Bush, George Michael, Cyndi Lauper, Rage Against the Machine, Willie Nelson, Soundgarden, A Tribe Called Quest. And then among those, the White Stripes and the Spinners. The Spinners, of course, from Ferndale, had a number of hits. And then, of course, you've got Jack White and his sister? Sister, wife?
Ex-wife.
Ex-wife. Okay, yeah. The thing that caught my eye is, like, these artists are, we're getting into a time, and I'm somebody who, and look, there are, of course, good musicians and good artists and all those things now, but, like, I'm somebody who believes that, like, most of our music now is crap. Like, it's just awful. Like,
tell us more, Grandpa.
I know, whatever, I don't care. I like what I like. I think it's terrible. I think it's like prepackaged, stale.
Well, you know when the best
music, it's awful.
You know when the best music came out? Whenever you were a teenager. Whenever you were a teenager.
I know, I disagree. I'm like, I like, you know, Zeppelin and the Beatles, and I'm into that. But I just think there's been music has changed, and it's very, like, sanitized.
Okay, let's not overreact, because these are just finalists, right? They're not going into the Hall of Fame. They're nominees.
Yeah, these aren't even finalists.
So baseball just selected Scott Rolen to go into the Baseball Hall of
Fame.
Yeah,
sure.
These are some players who were on the ballot.
Okay.
John Lackey, Johnny Peralta, Jared Weaver, Francisco Rodriguez, former Tiger closer Francisco Rodriguez. So, sure.
How dare you besmirch Francisco Rodriguez?
I mean, you can compare it to your Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominees. They're not all going to get in.
No. Of course not. But overall, Sheryl Crow, Missy Elliott, Iron Maiden, who I thought was in already. Like Willie Nelson also should have been in. I don't know what we're doing with Willie.
Right.
Willie could go at any moment. Like, get this guy into the hall.
You know, I think their big mistake, too, is calling themselves the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They should be called the Music Hall of Fame.
Well, but that's like, I used to think that, and then I was like, whatever.
I mean, Sheryl Crow was huge for a long time. I don't think she's misplaced being in there.
But she's a Hall of Famer?
I think she makes sense in the Hall of Fame. Soundgarden, they're on the border. I mean, they're not as big as Pearl Jam or Nirvana right. was in the grunge scene, but Chris Cornell is genuinely accepted as one
like,
of the best.
Rage is somebody I get. Like, Rage was like a different deal. But the thing that caught my eye is like these artists are. I would never have thought like, oh, good, Sheryl Crow's going to be in the Hall of Fame.
I mean,
oh,
I see
Kate Bush. Sure, of course, Kate Bush should definitely be in the Hall of Fame.
I see five slam dunks on here who should be in the Hall of Fame, and the rest, like Nick said, are just nominees.
This feels watered down. It feels like we're going to start getting into the era of, like, you know,
the Chocolate Rain guy getting in.
Yeah, right. Sure. No,
which I'd be fine with.
It's cyclical, right? Like everything is in cycles. And just because of my view of like modern music, it's all the same stuff. So I just found it interesting that we are now getting into an era. It's almost like when you're watching sports and like the players are younger than you. Like that's pretty weird.
I hate that.
Yeah. So we're getting into this era. All right, that's going to do it for us. Mitch Allam and the crew coming up next here on WJR.